People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
Every now and then, a guest is so knowledgeable and articulate that we must invite her back, such as the case with today's featured expert, Diane Spaulding, Executive Director of the Nonprofit Housing Association of Northern California, best known as NPH. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and on this episode of the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing, we'll be discussing the challenges and opportunities for inclusionary housing. Diane Spaulding's been the executive director of NPH for 20 years. The organization supports over 750 members representing housing practitioners and developers of affordable housing, primarily in the nine counties and cities around the San Francisco Bay Area. Under Diane's leadership, NPH has gained a national reputation for many of its capacity-building initiatives, including the areas of technical assistance and training, inclusionary zoning, housing element campaigns, community acceptance strategies, planning, and other groundbreaking approaches to boosting the supply of affordable housing production. Diane, welcome back to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, Joanne.
I thought it had been about a year, and you pointed it out to me that it was more like 5 years. So
a lot, and a lot's happened in that period for the housing market in California.
I would say so. Like, to give our listeners a broader context, please tell us a little bit more about NPH and how you make a difference in the affordable housing arena.
Sure. Well, we are going to be celebrating our 35th year next year. And we were formed as a membership association to build our collective power, raise awareness about the importance of affordable housing. We provide programs and services that basically provide technical assistance. We work on policy development. We try to make RAIN create funding streams for the affordable housing sector so that they can build the desperately needed affordable housing that we all know is an unmet need in our region and in our state.
So let's define inclusionary housing. Is inclusionary housing the same as inclusionary zoning, or are they two different things?
No, they are synonymous, and they are basically a requirement by a city or a county on market rate developers to provide some type of affordable housing when they are building a new development. In California and in the Bay Area, as is typical of California, we're so unique, every inclusionary policy in our state is different. This is actually a good thing, and we can talk about that later. Most of these programs are mandatory, others are voluntary, but they all share a common goal, which is to establish a relatively permanent source of affordable housing stock.
Do the voluntary programs work?
Actually, they do. Mandatory, we think, is probably better. And one of the features about inclusionary housing that is a positive is that they usually provide a range of options for the developers within the ordinance on how they're going to meet this affordable housing requirement. So, for example, they can choose to build the affordable homes as a part of the development. They can actually choose to pay a fee, often called an in-lieu fee, that goes into usually some sort of local housing trust fund, and then it will be used later to build affordable housing nearby. And then a third option, which Eden is particularly adept at, is partnering a for-profit and a nonprofit on a particular development, and the for-profit developer will build the market rate component, and then the nonprofit will build the affordable component. And sometimes they will be right next to each other. Sometimes they will be, down the street. But it's that partnership that really works quite well to accomplish the goal of building the affordable housing.
What kinds of incentives are given to market rate developers in order to include affordable housing units in their developments?
Well, once again, we're back to there is a state density bonus law, so they which is a pretty powerful incentive. So they can build at higher densities if they agree to do affordable. And then, as I mentioned at the outset, each of these ordinances is different. So. In every community, there will be a variety of different types of incentive depending upon what that city decided to include in their ordinance. So, for example, they could do streamlined building, permitting, one-stop shopping. They can actually provide technical assistance to developers. There are a lot of ways that incentives are built. They can do reduced parking requirements, for example. But all of them are in the context of each project and in each local community so that they are appropriate for that development and that particular community.
And that's why you say it's fine that they're all different. It's not just a matter of giving lawyers something to do here.
Right. One size, does not, it allows every city. It provides maximum flexibility, and it provides every city the opportunity to essentially customize a program and ordinance to build affordable housing that meets their unique community needs. And every community in California is truly unique. So, yes, that is one of the, pluses of this approach.
Big question, Diane. Why is inclusionary housing so controversial?
A simple answer, I'll give you two answers, Joanne. A simple answer would be that policies that potentially the perception that they may increase the cost of building housing or that they cast some sort of uncertainty on the entitlement process causes concern within the development community. The one thing you will always hear any kind of developer say is that they need certainty. We happen to believe that inclusionary housing actually isn't controversial. It allows cities and developers to share the cost of the housing that's being built. And you've got to keep in mind that real estate developers are bottom line oriented. So a developer is not going to develop a project if they can't make a make it pencil and they can't make a profit. They're not it's not going to get built. So once again, we feel like the kind of dramatic market conditions that our sector has been encountering over the last 5 years since we talked, is a great example of in a high cost area like the Bay Area and in a region like the Bay Area where it's a strong housing market. Because a lot of people want to live here and production has not kept up with demand, you would think that possibly those market conditions would lead to developers saying that they don't want to build inclusionary. And in fact, we have not seen a significant reduction in the production of these kinds of developments because inclusionary is extremely cost effective and it's a way for cities and counties to provide affordable housing actually in an era of diminished resources. They actually don't have to. It's a market-based solution to providing housing that meets the needs of all of its community residents, and it offers them the ability to tailor the program, and it actually doesn't cost them anything to do so. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to your question. And my concluding point in that would be that the Nonprofit Housing Association doesn't believe it's a controversial policy. We actually believe it's a tried and true, proven public policy solution that works and builds affordable housing for very low-income people.
Point well taken. So given the housing market slowdown, I think it's probably fair to assume that private developers are going to try to convince local officials to rescind local inclusionary housing policies or at least suspend some of the requirements. So are you now waging a fight to prevent the cities from undoing all the work that NPH has accomplished?
Well, we are, but fortunately, only a few jurisdictions have actually rolled back their inclusionary policies in response to the economic downturn. I can give you one example in the Bay Area, Brentwood. They changed their requirement from 10%. Inclusionary down to 2%. And for a brief period of time, the city of Concord temporarily suspended their policy. But we continue to work with every community. You know, there are 110 jurisdictions in the Bay Area, 9 counties and 101 cities, and we work with all of them and will continue to advocate and ensure that inclusionary policies are in place when market conditions are more favorable, which they are. Certainly we've seen improvement within the last 6 to 9 months, and that's a good thing.
Inclusionary housing has had a few legal challenges. Can you describe the Palmer case and its impact on local ordinances?
Okay. So the Palmer decision arose out of a development in the city of L.A. L.A. did not have an inclusionary policy, but they had a requirement for a specific plan area where that development was happening. And there was a lawsuit, and the court decision came down and basically said that an inclusionary requirement would conflict with an existing law that you often hear people talk about, the Costa-Hawkins law. And that is a state law that allows a landlord whose rental property would otherwise be subject to local rent control laws to increase the rent if one of the tenant moves out. So this lawsuit basically said that the city of LA couldn't require a below market rent or any fee connected in any way to rents. So that lawsuit triggered an interpretation really by every city attorney all over the state of California, where there was, any kind of inclusionary zoning requirement. And each, city attorney has looked and interpreted the law differently. In most cases, anytime there's a lawsuit that potentially raises the specter of uncertainty or the risk that a inclusionary housing requirement may not withstand scrutiny makes people nervous. So, we went to the legislature and asked a very progressive assembly member, Tony Atkins from the San Diego area, to sponsor legislation. It's AB Assembly Bill 1229, and it's a very simple bill that if it's passed and it is moving in the legislature, it would clarify that the intention of the state legislature, our state legislature, between this Costa-Hawkins rent control bill and inclusionary, it would clarify that they were not related, and that jurisdictions should be allowed and should continue to enforce inclusionary housing requirements and adopt new inclusionary housing requirements in all types of housing. And so, you know, the rub comes with what you, the very good question that you asked earlier, Joanne, which is around the, you know, is inclusionary housing controversial? And certainly within some sectors, such as the home builders, the California Home Builders Association, they feel like they unfairly bear the burden of the cost of inclusionary. We don't, as I said earlier, believe that is actually the case. And so we hope that this bill will prevail, and it will kind of put to rest once and for all that this, you know, single court case in the city of LA really is not applicable at all to inclusionary zoning. There have been a couple of other cases of note here in the Bay Area. The oldest inclusionary zoning policy in the state is actually in our backyard. It was passed by the city of Palo Alto. It was recently challenged by litigation unsuccessfully. There's a case that was filed also in Sunnyvale. It's currently at the appellate level. It was challenged unsuccessfully in a lower court. And then San Jose very boldly went where few would go. They actually adopted their inclusionary zoning policy, a new policy, in January of 2010, after the Palmer decision came down, and it's currently also being contested in court. But the reports that we're getting are that are hopeful that San Jose is going to prevail in their adoption of that ordinance. And that's pretty important given that San Jose is, you know, a very large city in California and the largest in our backyard.
So let me ask you this. We have many affordable housing advocates listening to our podcast right now. Is there anything that you would urge them to do to register their support for AB 1229?
Oh, absolutely. They can, you know, certainly contact NPH for a template of a letter of support. There, as I mentioned, the author is Assemblymember Tony Atkins. There are many co-authors. We have all of that information available on our website, and we can provide the hearing schedule and all of that. So that would be the appropriate action, would be to write letters of support.
Great. And we will give your web address at the end of this podcast, so that's people great. Will have that. Now, are there any other ways around the Palmer decision where localities can still require affordable housing in market rate rental projects?
Well, you know, cities can still negotiate affordability requirements in a development agreement. They can certainly do that. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, this is a gray area that is being litigated, and therefore each city has a city attorney and a housing staff, and so, you know, many cities are continuing to operate as business as usual until you know, until the courts ultimately decide. So those are a couple of ways.
Diane, California's housing element law requires jurisdictions to create realistic opportunities for meeting regionally determined affordable housing targets. Has that law made it more difficult to eliminate inclusionary housing policies without legal consequence?
Not in our perspective, no.
Okay.
I would say the issue that has had the most profound impact on the status of inclusionary zoning recently, it relates to the elimination of redevelopment agencies.
Okay. Inclusionary policies depend on market rate development in order to be successful. So what happens in market downturns? It seems like it's an inconsistent strategy given market fluctuation. What are some other local strategies that can be used when inclusionary housing isn't an option for production?
Well, you can... there are things called housing impact fees. A housing impact fee is usually a per square foot fee that's levied on market rate housing that can be used to build affordable homes. And, you know, the fees are based on the idea that every person that moves into a market rate home is going to generate a need for services that require employees who make less than the area median income. So a housing impact fee, it does require a nexus study, and it can be applied to apartment homes, to single family homes, to new additions and to remodels. So actually housing impact fees is kind of for us the what we're pushing and advocating for locally now, as another alternative to inclusionary.
So we all know that redevelopment agencies were eliminated in California in 2011. Did that undermine many inclusionary housing policies? I know redevelopment law, for example, had its own form of inclusionary requirements. Can you describe those?
I can. I would say first that one of the most profound impacts of the loss of redevelopment agencies that I think was kind of hidden from view is that under California redevelopment law was a mandate for every community to produce affordable housing. And the mandate was that for tax increment financing that was being collected by these redevelopment agencies, they were required to spend a minimum of 20% on it for low to moderate income housing. And in some places, San Francisco is a great example. In a place like San Francisco, they never viewed the 20%. As a minimum or as a floor. They usually spent 55, even 60% of that money on affordable housing production. So we lost the mandate to produce housing. And then on top of that, redevelopment law also did have, as you've mentioned, Joanne, it had a requirement that 15% of all of the housing built in redevelopment areas, would be for low to very low income households. That is another, the law eliminating redevelopment agencies in 2011, there are so many aspects of it that are unclear. There are so many aspects of it that are still being unwound. There, believe it or not, this is 2013. There are still regulatory and legislative approaches to try to work. How do you dismantle a law of 60 plus years in a year or in 2 years? You don't. The answer is you don't. So this is an area that is still very unclear. It is certainly on our advocacy platform to try to get to try to get clarity. And at some point, we will probably try to push. Once we get clarity, then we will try to push possibly for some sort of statewide inclusionary zoning or inclusionary housing program to replace this mandate. Because you asked at the very beginning, Joanne, about voluntary versus mandatory. Do they work? It's kind of like with housing elements. If you don't plan and do a really good housing element, which is essentially your housing element is your plan for how are you going to meet the housing needs of your community. If you don't have a good plan, and you don't execute the plan, then you will fail to build. And that has happened. And that is one of the reasons why we are behind the eight ball in California and are losing ground in terms of meeting the needs of our workforce and meeting the needs of our low and very low-income households. So that is probably a consequence of the elimination of redevelopment agencies that we see as extremely problematic. And on top of that, I think one of the unforeseen challenges is that when you eliminated redevelopment agencies, pretty much a lot of people lost their jobs. A lot of public agency staff were laid off, and a lot of public agencies had to consolidate, and the consequence, you know, the consequences of that, combined with the other dramatic state budget cuts that took place when the redevelopment agencies were eliminated, means that there aren't a lot of people working on these important issues that we care about to get the work done, and that's really a shame.
And challenging. Always wanting to end on a high note. What are some examples across the country of where inclusionary housing policies have actually been strengthened or expanded during the economic downturn?
Well, you know, I would actually refer your listeners to an excellent organization called the National Housing Conference, and they have a staff person who used to work for NPH, and his name is Robert Hickey, and he recently produced a report on the status of inclusionary zoning across the country. And he did drill down on some major metropolitan areas. And I would steer your listeners to their website, which is www.nhc.org. The publication is there. It's easily downloadable. It's not a long report, but it is a very informative report. And basically, the conclusion is that this economic downturn has really not dampened the enthusiasm of this tool by local governments across the country. So I would encourage everyone who's interested in this subject to take a look at that report.
And once again, that URL is nhc.org. And what is yours if people want to learn more again about that Palmer Fix legislation, AB 1229 by Tony Adkins?
Ours is www.nonprofithousing.org.
Great. Diane, it was a pleasure to have you on the podcast, and we hope you're going to be willing to return yet again sometime to enlighten our listeners.
Well, Joanne, I'll give you a teaser to say goodbye, and that is we're working on a regional quality of life measure that would, for the Bay Area, create a new revenue stream to tap into for our affordable housing developers like Eden to access to build desperately needed housing. And I'd love to come back and talk about that to you sometime soon.
It's a deal.
Great. Thanks so much, Joanne.
You're very welcome. Diane Spaulding, executive director for 20 years now of the Nonprofit Housing Association of Northern California. To learn more about Eden Housing or to hear prior episodes of the Affordable Housing Podcast, please visit edenhousing.org.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.